Welcome to Top M&A Entrepreneurs. Today, and on this episode, I interview Ross Turner. Ross Turner works with Carl Allen. They're 50-50 partners. They started a holding company to acquire e-commerce companies in the women's space. Ross went out and raised $235 million of commitments from large investors to go buy these companies. And we're going to hear about Ross's story, how he did it, what he looks for, what he had to say, etc. So stay tuned. Here it comes. Ross Turner, welcome to Top M&A Entrepreneurs. How are you doing?
I'm great. Thank you for having me. It's an honor and a privilege to be here. I'm great. How are you, John?
I'm good. And I just was on a webinar a week ago, and I saw you raised $100 million to acquire e-commerce companies, $1 million to $5 million EBITDA. I want to talk to you about how you got there.
Sure. Yeah. So actually, last year, the cumulative total of capital committed was $235
million. $235 million. Now,
yeah. And I have zero background in finance. I'm not an investment banker. My background is not that. But I had to learn it very quickly over the last year and really understand what goes on in that world, how it works, how people think. And really, it's been an interesting journey for sure.
Yeah. So let's kind of rewind a little bit, like the hero's journey. You know, you're back on the, you're Luke Skywalker on some planet like that's going nowhere.
I'm definitely not that.
Yeah. But you were, you've been in digital marketing for 20 years. So You've got that expertise of taking a company from X to XXX, whatever that was, right?
Correct. Yeah.
Yeah.
So I originally started out in direct response and digital in 2003. So 2003, me and my brother, back in the UK, we had a digital info product business, which we ran for 7 years. We grew that to multiple seven figures. And really how this kind of whole journey started was at the end of 2013, I was fairly burnt out and I just gave the business to my brother. I just said, look, there's no scalability here. Like, I've learned pretty much everything there is to learn. So I was writing all of the emails, all of the copy, all of the launch material, all of the webinars, everything. And essentially in the market that we were in, and I won't divulge it because my brother's still running that business, there was no ability to scale it, right? Like we couldn't scale it due to several restrictions that we had. So I just gave him the business and I said, look, I'm burnt out. I need a bit of time away from it. And I remember it very vividly, actually. So I spent a month on my mum's sofa. I was like just turning 30. I was just like, what the hell am I going to do? And for a month, I just sat there, just gave my brain a rest. I'd kind of had enough. And then serendipitously, someone who I learned to write copy from, Andre Chaperone, incredible guy, autoresponder madness. He is a legendary copywriter. He actually sent out an email that said, are you my next Emilio? And that email was on behalf of his business partner, Steve Gray. Steve runs multiple 8-figure supplement direct response businesses online. He's like one of the premier guys who drives traffic. And I read his email and I was like, well, I can absolutely do this. And it was to be his intern, right? So I reached out, I replied to the email, and then I turned around and just said, here's everything I've done over the last 7 years. He looked at the material and then he called me and he said, look, you're far too experienced. I was going to pay an intern 25 grand to basically sit in my office and do all the grunt work. He said, but I have a business partner in Austin who needs some help running that business. Would you like to do that? So I Googled Austin. I was like, where the hell's Austin? I had no idea where it is. And I've lived here for 10 years now and I absolutely love it, right?
Where were you living in England?
Just south of England. So I was living in Kent. I was in a village called Charing, which is about It's about an hour away from London. So it's a nice, picturesque, Garden of England kind of space. And then I'll never forget this. So I ended up coming out here on the 4th of June, 2014. And that was it. I fell in love with it. I was the fifth employee in that year. And I knew, I was like, if I can, there's two things in the direct response and digital space, right? If you learn how to drive traffic and you know how to write copy, you can write your own ticket. Sky's the limit. And I got there. I was a fifth employee in. We did 2.2 million that year. By the time I left, 4 years later, we were on a $35 million run rate. And I'd helped grow that team to about 40 people.
And this was, what kind of company was this?
It's a survival company.
Survival. Oh, are we talking about
end of the world preppers here?
Ryan Dice's digital
marketing. No, it's not. It's not Ryan. No. It's not Ryan Dice's company. No, the company was called Ultimate Survival Strategies. There were several of these companies. Crisis Education was another one. Austin seemed to spawn a lot of survivalist companies. It was big business. Like, I didn't realize how big until I actually started working for it. For them, and my girlfriend at the time, who's now my wife, she was doing a master's degree in crime, terrorism, and global securities. But she was over here with me, but she was bored. So I got her a job in customer service. So she would literally speak with angry middle-aged white guys all day long about their survival products that they bought, the survival food they bought. So
preppers.
That opened up her eyes to kind of the digital and direct response.
I have to tell you, like, I just remember about 10, and I think 5 years ago, I went through one of those funnels to get a $4 flashlight, and it ended up spending like $300 through that freaking funnel.
So what we did was, when I first came into that business, we shifted our model very similar to a free plus shipping model.
Yeah.
And it was a free book on the front end. And we changed that complete model. I think I ended up selling 100,000 copies of this book. But really, it was to drive people into our continuity, right? Like, our cash flow was determined by our membership. And then I split tested and took, when I came into the business, we were selling our newsletter for $19.95. So we collected all the data, pulled it together, and then I tested 37, 47, 57, 67. And the attrition and drop-off rate was the same. So I took it from $19.95 a month to $67 a month. So like 4x the business. And then we were driving so many people into that front end that our take rate on that subscription was 52%. So we grew that. We had like 1,500 people on the newsletter when I turned up, and we grew that to over 14,000.
That was like a free plus shipping book that you'd upsell to the, hey, just click here if you want the newsletter for $67 a year.
So how we structured it was, if they bought the book on the front end, we'd either, depending on the product, we either offer them the same book for $1 today, but they had to test drive our newsletter for 14 days. So we tested 30 days, 21 days, 14 days. And then it turned out that 14 days was the optimal kind of time. And we just scaled that thing to over 14,000 subscribers.
Yeah, this was way before the ClickFunnels, the free plus shipping.
Before that. We had our own internal team that were building all of our pages and stuff out for us. The guys today don't know how easy they've got it. Like, back in the day, it used to be a real effort to kind of put all these funnels together. We used Infusionsoft. One shopping cart, if you remember that. Trying to get a one-click upsell flow and path was difficult. And we were one of the first kind of guys to do that. And then I guess ever since then, I kind of left there. I ran a couple of other businesses. One was in finance. It was like a financial services product. One was in, again, back into supplements, health and fitness, direct response. And then really kind of stumbled onto Carl, essentially. Like, how that kind of relationship came about was, we were both in similar direct response groups and we were friends, because we're from like a similar part of the UK. We love football.
When you say football, we mean soccer.
You mean soccer, yes.
Football, yeah.
Yes, football. Yeah, we call
Here's
it
a little
football.
Fact. My dad was in the Air Force, and my first sport I played was football. In Germany.
Right.
It was soccer.
Oh, there you go.
It's soccer, not football.
Yeah. It's soccer for you guys. Yeah.
Yeah.
So we kind of built up a relationship, had a friendship. We just chatted. Like, I'd speak to him on the phone about a few things before we even kind of ever got into this. And then I kind of helped him out. They were relaunching Dealmaker Well Society. And I just, I guess I can say this on the podcast, but I'd spent $10,000 on Roland Fraser's Epic. And I couldn't make any heads or tails of it. It was all over the place. There was no structure to it. I was like, I can't make this work. But I said to Carl, I said, one of the things that Roland and his team are doing exceptionally well is they're running this challenge. I said, you should absolutely do that. So they went and their team modeled it on that, and it helped 7x the business. So he turned around and said, hey, why don't you come into Prodigy? He said, I'll give you a free, I'll comp you into it. And I said, no. I said, like, that's a mistake. If you give it to me for free, I'll probably never look at it. I said, let me pay for it. I'm happy to pay for it. And it's a complete true story. So a couple of years before that, unfortunately, my father passed away during COVID. And then he left me some inheritance. It was £12,000, which wasn't a lot. And I spent 7,000 of that on Carl's course.
Yeah.
So paid for it, got in there.
I think that's critically important to make sure you did that, because I've given away a lot of products and people, it's shelfware. I can go in and see how many people looked at it or even did any of the courses. Zero. It's shelf. Yeah. You have to pay for it.
I think I've read somewhere that 80% of the people that buy courses and training never do anything with it anyway.
Yeah.
Which just kind of like blows my mind a little bit. But I went through his material and I like the structure to it. They gamify it, right? So they force you into taking action, which is very important. Like, especially if you're new, you need someone to guide you along the way and kind of show you the ropes. But it was a funny story. So Carl was super patient with me. And back then, when you kind of became part of the team, he'd have an individual one-on-one welcome call with you. And he kind of like bugged me about having this call. And for about 6 months, I didn't really do anything with it, and I was umming and ahhing. So he finally gets me on the call, and then I'm like, I think I should probably buy direct response e-commerce companies. And he said, he went, hallelujah, thankfully, the penny has dropped. He said, I was waiting for you to say that.
He was waiting for you to come.
He was waiting for me to come to the table. And then he said, great. He said, why don't we partner on it? And I was like, I don't know. I said, like, just let me think about it. And I went away, and I hadn't committed at that point to it. But then he kind of calls me on a Sunday and says, hey, are you free? Can you jump on Zoom? So we jumped on a Zoom, and he modeled out basically our roadmap to $1 billion enterprise value company.
And he was just looking for you, like a blank spot there in who's going to do this. And well, he's probably tried it a couple times, but
one of the big things with Carl, what he said was, he said he's kicked himself back in the day. He got the opportunity to partner in a legal cannabis grow, which got sold for $120 million or something.
Yeah.
And he turned it down. So now he's like, tries to partner with as many people as possible. So he showed this model to me, and it was up to 16 deals over 6 years. And it was an enterprise value of $982 million. So I looked at it. We got on Zoom. We were talking through it, and I said, "All right." I said, "Let me think about it, right?" Because the biggest thing, if you're doing a roll up, is integration and operations, right?
Yeah.
And being in this space, like those things need to be tied down. You need to have world class people doing that. And then secondarily, I thought, well, I don't want to just sell to men and women, because the communication, the marketing, the conversation can be too difficult, right?
Two different messages.
Too different. And then we don't get the economies of scale. We can't cross-sell as much. So I went away and I thought about it. And I said to Carl, I was like, yeah, I think this is possible. I think this is doable. And I'll be honest, John, like originally when we first did this, it was kind of like not an ego thing, but I saw the big number, right? And I was like, wow, $1 billion, we can do this. It was about that initially. But then when I started pulling all the data and looking at everything that I'd kind of started to put together, I realized that women were the super buyers in our space. They spend seven times more than men. They control the purse strings. They're a better customer. They're stickier. They're just a super buyer. And then because obviously we were coming into, 2022, we're looking at the recession, looking at the economy. We wanted something that was bulletproof, bombproof, and that had continued to grow even during COVID. So we settled on women's health, wellness, and beauty products. It's been growing
they
19% year on year. Yeah.
They spend like $200 to $700 more than men do on beauty
it's
products.
It's crazy, right? Yeah. It's actually $1,700 more than men.
$1,700 more. I got to adjust. It's crazy, right? Yeah. It's like, Jesus.
So I looked at that. And the original deal was, you'll laugh, like if you saw our original deck, you could tell two men had put it together, right? It was like blue and masculine, and we covered all of the key notes that you need to when obviously you're putting a deck together like that. And you'll know this never happens, right? So we pitched it to a family office. Carl was like, if we get 10 million of equity, we can couple that with debt, earn out, seller notes, all that good stuff. And that gets us to our target. I was like, okay. So we pitched this to a family office in Dallas, and I won't name him. And we pitched it three times over three kind of separate calls. And we couldn't really get a sense of if he enjoyed it, understood it, liked the project. And then we had a random email at like midnight that said, you guys are onto something, let's do it. So that was odd.
So it was quick validation, but you didn't know whether. Let me rewind just a tiny bit and the sticky situation of slicing up the pie. Like when you say partner, what is it? 50-50? Is it what is it looking like?
Yeah. So the deal was $10 million for 20% equity in the business, right? When we'd also give them a redemption premium on that money.
So no, I'm sorry. I'm referring to Carl, you and Carl.
Oh, me and Carl. Yeah. That's 50-50.
Oh, 50-50. Cool.
Super simple. 50-50. We literally just said, we'll split it down the middle. I have to say, Carl's the best business partner I've ever had, ever.
What is it about him that makes it the best?
He has a unique ability. Like when it comes to numbers and deal structure, I've never seen anything quite like it. Like he spent 2 hours on a whiteboard doing it in his head, did a full pro forma. But he really understands people. So like he lets me and gives me the freedom to get on with it because he trusts me. And then I don't hassle him either. Like if there's specific things I need from him, I say, hey, Carl, I need this, this, and this. And he just does it instantly. He also has obviously, 31 years of M&A experience. So he can bring things to the table that I haven't necessarily thought of. But yeah, we split it right down the middle, 50-50.
Yeah, by the way, I've done an interview with Carl talking about his HP M&A experience. So
yeah,
it's in my catalog if you want to go watch that. Yeah,
I will. I will check that out. So yeah, it was an interesting story. So the family office, they were like, yep, we like this. We're in. Well, we had the contracts drawn up. We saw their capital commitments, their proof of funds, and then we had a timeline of execution for the capital call. And then what the family office did was they started opening up their connections to us. And then that kind of led us down the road to the first big raise, right? And there's a company out of New York. They're an alternative investment group. They're called Global Emerging Markets, GEM. They're three high net worth individuals. And they say publicly they've announced that they have 3 billion AUM. But privately, when we sat down and spoke with them, it's more like 11. So their model is they're essentially, I think in old terminology, it's called a pipe on Wall Street. So when we become a publicly listed company, they have given us legally contractually obligated to buy $125 million worth of our shares. So they have to buy that. There's two good things about this company. One is they're long only. They can't short the stock ever. and they can't even do anything for it, they can't even do anything with it for 5 years. So they have a vested interest in the growth of the business. So we again, and you know this never happens, right? So we pitched Gregory Van Beek, and I didn't know this at the time. They hadn't done a deal in 3 years. They turned down 50 deals. And then we pitched him, and I'm about two-thirds of the way through this pitch. And he stops me, and he says, I absolutely love what you guys are doing here. He said, but you have to do one thing. He said, stop saying females. He said, and start saying women. He said, because I've got three daughters at home, and every time I say female, they tell me off. So
that's a little tiny nuance.
Yeah. So he turned around and said, how much do you want? And this is the only time I've ever been unprepared for a meeting like this. That's never happened again.
Was Carl with you? Or Carl just you two?
Yeah, Carl was on the call. We were both on there. And I just blurted out 150 million. So he laughed and he said, all right, leave it with me. Let me come back. He came back kind of over the weekend and we settled on 125. And from term sheet to contract, it took about 6 months. Kind of iron out all the red line, and you know how that goes.
Yeah. Lawyers, did you guys already have your 50-50 corporation in place, the holding company, before you went? Yeah, there's.
Yeah, that was already done. Yeah. So that was already in play. And then, of course, now we've got a little bit of traction, right? We've got commitment from the family office. We've got a $125 million facility when we become a publicly listed company. We're away at the races. Unfortunately, what we didn't know at the time, which wasn't disclosed to us, the family office was selling their family office to another family office. They were getting their money from LPs, and they missed the capital call. So me and Carl pulled the 20% from them. We pulled it. We're like, no, because we'd signed our contract with
that's your lead investor.
Yeah. Well, they missed the capital call. Plus, we've already signed this contract with Jim. So we're like, well, they're not bringing the money to the table. We pulled it. So we pulled the deal and took the equity back. And we're like, well, we'll just go and raise the money elsewhere. And that's kind of how it led me down this road and down this journey. Because what I did was, and it took me about, again, I'm not the smartest person in the room. So it took me about 90 days to figure this out, right? Do you know how hard it is to raise 10 million than it is to raise 100? It's easier to.
It's incredibly hard to get 50,000 from an accredited investor. It's a lot easier to get 10 million from an institutional investor.
Yeah. 100 checks from a 50 to 100 million up are much easier to get. And the reason is these institutions and groups don't want to deal with the 1 to 10 million size because the work's exactly the same and the upside isn't as much. So it's actually easier to go after bigger chunks of capital. So one of the things that we learned when we were kind of going through this process when the family office pulled out is we wanted some redundancy. So the way that we structured the company, we've got our holding co, which is Econfolio at the top. And then underneath, we've got individual SPVs where the capital is deployed into that individual SPV. And that's beholden to that organization and not the top co. So after I kind of spent 90 days banging my head against a brick wall wondering why I couldn't raise this 10 million, I started opening up conversations with people in my network who kind of turned me on to larger project financing, larger debt project funds, and basically some high level kind of middle market PE guys. And they walked me through it essentially. So we ended up going at the end of last year, we ended up with four term sheets, each for 55 million. And then we were like, well, let's pick two. Because if we pick two, we have 55 million in SPV one, we have 55 million in SPV two, we'll go and do bigger deals. And then if and when we become publicly listed, we can access that capital. So we decided on two groups. One of the groups actually who we're speaking to at the moment is US Capital Global. If you've heard of them, they're huge.
Yeah, they're out of San Francisco too.
Yeah. They're huge. They like turned us around a term sheet within 24 hours and they were like, let's go. We love it. We want to do this deal. But strategically, we didn't go with them at the tail end of last year. So we did two different models. One is project financing with a large corporation. They're a private corporation. So it's a 10-year term interest only, 8%, with a balloon at the end. So we had to, obviously, we had to go through extreme due diligence. We had to provide the pro forma, which supported the cash flow to pay off the balloon at the end. So that is right at the closing signing table right now, literally ready to ink that deal. And then we can draw down on that capital within a 90-day period. And then the second group that we used,
let me ask you about that. So these are the support letters that you get when you go to say, like, Quiet Riot, and go, hey, I love this $5 million EBITDA company you got in cosmetic industry. Okay, provide proof of funding. You go, hey, I got this U.S. Global, support letter here up to $55 million. You good with that? We're good.
Yep. That's kind of how it works. But one of the groups who we're working with, they provided us with proof of funds, $100 million commitment letter, and also $655 million of cash in a landing account. So we're like, here you go. So that kind of smooths over a lot of the conversations that we have, right?
Yeah.
But being exposed to this kind of behind the scenes high level finance is quite terrifying, really, to be honest. It's terrifying to see how they do it. So one of the groups, like I said, one was project financing for 55, and the other group who we went with, they've been doing corporate bonds since 1995. And the principal in charge, and I've seen the SEC filings to back this up, he's done $8.9 billion in bond raises. I was like, what? And so essentially what they do is he takes $55 million of his own cash, puts it in an escrow account. So this bond is backed by cash. It's then turned into a bond, then sent to an investment bank. They then sell it into Wall Street. And then it's insured. So if anything goes wrong, the original investors get all of their money back.
Yeah, my friend used to do bonds for the state of Tucson, Tucson City. So, and it's, you know, they raised like $4 billion in bonds. You know, states don't default. They just refinance them and the paper moves on to somebody else.
Exactly that. Yeah. It was crazy. Like when we were introduced to that, it's kind of like blown my mind. I was like, I can't believe this actually happened. So,
they need good opportunities to put their money to make what percent? Yeah.
Yeah, they do. And again,
8%.
I know, it's crazy. The bond that we were doing was actually 7. So, like, which is wild. But it's been an interesting journey up to this stage, right? It hasn't been without its fair share of challenges. We've had to pivot a lot. There's a couple of other, like, intrinsic nuances with this business. So we're just about to sign the warrants agreement. We're going to be on the Going Public TV show. So we're going to be on that.
Yeah, I know that guy. What's his name?
Darren Marley.
Yeah, I'm first connections with him on LinkedIn. I known him for quite some time, yeah.
He's a really good guy, Darren. Really good guy. So we're going to be on the show. We're also opening up an office in Miami because the mayor, Venture Miami, they're having a huge drive to bring global technology into Miami, right? They're trying to make it the new Silicon Valley.
So a lot of big investment companies are moving down to Florida.
Yeah.
It's a pro-business state, as is Texas. Yeah.
Yep. So we're so the mayor of Miami and his wife actually hosting us a welcome ceremony for the business. We're going to have the Going Public guys kind of film all of that. And then we're going to have like a 500 female founder Shark Tank style pitch event. So there's a whole host of moving parts, and this kind of business has got a lot of attention and traction on its own merit. And I'm trying to like slow the train down a little bit because now we have to get the companies into our model. We have to close on, there's two right now, which we're looking to close on. And then we have to start looking at the full woman C-suite, right? So our role right now is just to get this company to $10 million of EBITDA, and then we get the hell out of the way. So me and Carl get out of the way. We just become shareholders. We employ a full woman C-suite, and they drive that to the market cap of $1 billion.
Yeah.
And there's been some other things we've done in this business. We've got like an international distribution agreement with Open Border. which has been massive for us. We're going to be the only e-commerce use case platform on mechanized AI. Think of ChatGPT, but these guys are 5 years ahead of that. So we're going to be the only e-commerce platform, CPG brand, D2C, on their platform. So that's going to drive shareholder value in multiples.
Let me ask you about the support from the investors. So you can go buy an e-commerce company for $5 million now, and it's debt that they're offering. Is there the warrants have some kind of conversion mechanism when you go public that they can?
They can. So we've got, especially for the going public show, I'm not even sure if I'm supposed to say it, but it's fine. So they.
No, I think Darren's already talked about it.
They wanted a max ceiling of $50 million valuation, but we needed a minimum ceiling because what we did was originally when the family office pulled out, we kind of opened it up to individual founders and friends, and we raised like $1.5 million, giving them a smaller, the same deal as the family office, but on a smaller scale. So we did that based on a $10 million pre-revenue valuation. So with the warrants, we have a minimum ceiling of $30 million because obviously what we don't want to happen is they come around, turn around and value the business at $2.5 million, buy all the warrants, and then we're left with nothing. So So we've negotiated the minimum ceiling of $30 million, and the cap is $50 million. So that's that. Again, it's been super interesting to learn all of that.
This is all new to you, man. It's all brand new.
Yeah, I had no idea what the hell I was doing.
Was Carl the advisor? Like, hey, I'm going to ask this question like I've never heard it before because I haven't. So please go flow with me. Or do you have some other advisors you brought on to kind of lead you through this?
So the short answer is Carl was there like in a supporting role, but he's just let me get on with it. He's like, he's even come back to me and said, I don't know how you've managed to do what you've done. He said, you're just like smashing through walls. So I had to understand it from a baseline level myself anyway, which was kind of frustrating, right? I bought five books, the first three that I read. As you know, every single industry has its own language, right? Its own terminology, everything. For the first three books, I was just like, oh my God. Then the final two, things started to click. And then it was just a case of like, you learn so much more by doing, right? So you just get in there and sure, you make mistakes, and I made a ton. I do it regularly every day, but I keep picking up that knowledge, and now it's easy for me to go into these meetings and have conversations because I know what I'm talking about. But Paul was there as a sounding board, as an advisor, but he just let me get on with it. He's just like, go for it.
Yeah. When you, I got to go back to that, the deck that you presented to these investors. I mean, their hurdle rate was 7 to 8%. And you're talking about buying an e-commerce company that I'm going to just guess like, oh, we can get this to 15 to 30% growth if we do a couple of things here. Because I'm a direct marketing expert. Yeah. Mm.
Yeah, exactly that. And where we're playing, like the sweet spot that we're playing in, right? And we realized this very quickly. Now we actually don't want to look at anything that's doing less than 1.5 million in EBITDA.
That even sounds small because that's barely going to move the needle unless you see like a tremendous like untapped potential.
Yeah, well, this is the thing. So we're in it. We've got the – what's the word I'm looking for? We've got kind of the space to really look at these deals. Like we looked at 200 deals last year. 99% of them were just no. But the thing is, what we do is generally between the 2 million to 8, 9 million EBITDA range, right? It's generally owner operated and they don't know what they don't know. It takes a completely different skill set, John, to have a business that's doing 9, 10, 11 million a year to a run rate of 60 million. It's a completely different animal, right? You're right in the same space, but it's a completely different game. So one of the things that we have within our organization, and I've trademarked it, it's called our PP5 scalability strategy, and it's five profit pillars that we put into a business. So when we've looked at these companies, they'll do one or two things really well. So like one will be like they're expert marketers and they're driving all of their sales from Facebook, but they don't do any email. Whereas we come in and we do again, like to blitzkrieg the D2C space, it's very simple, right? And I think people get drawn into all these other areas, but really there's three main distribution channels: Google, and that includes YouTube, Facebook, and then you have influencers, and then you optimize and scale it. That is it, right? And then you add in additional things like phone support team, email. Email should be at least 40% of your revenue easily. Like one of the brands that we're going to acquire at the moment, they were doing 27 million top line, 6.2 million EBIT, and they don't email. I'm like, well,
they don't email.
They've got 600,000 people on their email list that don't email them.
Yeah. And this offer, what they're selling for, was it off market or on market?
It kind of came through a connection. It was on market, but it came through a third party and said, hey, you guys want
reasonable
to look at
fair valuation?
So, we're under exclusive.
Here's the problem. So you got a $235 million in the bank. You have this problem with probably overpaying because you're moving on speed now. Your momentum.
Well, yeah. So the thing with us, it gives us speed to close, right? Speed of execution. It kind of puts us ahead of the curve. But more than that, we want people vested and bought into our narrative, our project, right? Like one of the things we learned was that they have to be bought into the project, or we don't really want that business, right? Because when you're acquiring multiple companies, you're going to have a ton of, a ton of different moving parts. So we're lucky in as much as we can go after these really high target value companies, but also see where the growth and the potential is. But again, we're under exclusive LOI, so I can tell you this, right? Like, it doesn't really matter.
So, just keep it anonymized, whatever you do, because I don't want your attorney to come back and go, take this episode down.
No. So, and again, this is like insane deal. So they wanted 6.2 million in EBIT. We've got total consideration 16.5 million. Cash at close, 5. The rest is all earnout.
Earnout. And how did you structure that earnout? Was it like a top line revenue or profits? Because that's profit. Always a kind of a stickler.
It was done on profit, yeah. So we're buying it at just under 3x EBITDA.
That's a deal.
Great deal.
At a $6 million EBITDA company.
Yeah. Yes. And that gets us to 60% of the way to listing. Because our goal is 10 million of EBIT. We've already got 6.2 here. And then two of the other deals that we've got on the table, I can't mention them, but one is nearly a 20-year-old hair care company that are doing 40 million a year. And another one is a supplement business. And you're going to freak out on this. They're doing 40 million a year, 5 million in EBIT. They do zero paid advertising.
Yeah, no, I've heard of that before. I got another buddy kind of doing it on a lower level, and he's like, he told me he's bought this, I don't know what kind of protein powder it was, but it was amazing profits, like just throwing off cash.
Crazy, yeah. And again, it's like infinite scalability, right? Like you're literally only limited to your cash in, cash out, and how big you can scale these things.
Yeah.
So
are these in the United States or are they international? Yeah, they're
all US. One of the brands is actually international, so it's primarily US, but it's also in Europe as well, because we're going to be going there anyway.
It doesn't matter, right?
Doesn't matter, yeah.
Yeah.
But primarily USA-based businesses for sure.
Yeah, and then you buy these, and that's where you're at. Your intention is to install, I was just almost going to say female, but women leadership.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
How do you find women leadership that are, and I'm not saying you can't, I'm just saying that can take a company from 40 million to 100 million.
Yeah. So again, that's going to be a learning curve for us, right? Like these are the things that I don't know, but our board, so we've got a world-class advisory board. One of our advisors, Adam Burke, hey Adam, if you're listening to this, he's the original founder of Grubhub. And he's had three publicly listed companies and exits. Finding high-level C-suite executives is like his wheelhouse. We've also got Crystal Carson. She's like head of our capital markets, because she can have conversations I can't have. I'm not a woman, but she can actively go out and speak to people. And it's people who are interested in this project that we really want to magnetize ourselves to. Another lady who's, if all goes well, she'll be joining our board on Monday, is the ex-CMO of Sephora, Connie Young. So all of these very high level executives. And again, we're just going to have to go through the process. Like we run our company on EOS, right? And our implementer is a lady called Monica Justice, and she was managed $3 billion of retail products. She's got huge experience in this space. So she's coming in to run the EOS for each of these companies.
Yeah, let me ask you about that. Why did you do that and say, hey, we're just going to put women CEOs in these spots versus, I mean, there's a bigger inventory of, you
because
know,
the
men that run billion-dollar companies. Yeah,
there is, but the reality of it is the narrative and how we're positioned the story is women own businesses for women by women, right?
Yeah,
and they all
and
have
that was the on the deck that you
mm-hmm.
proposition to see, and that. How much do you think they said this? Well, we love making money, but we also want to do good,
yep.
or right, or equitable. What do they call it? Yeah,
yeah, it's impactful, right? Like,
yeah, impactful. Like
EPG. So one of the big things that was really important to us as we were kind of going through this. Obviously, me and Carl are two middle-aged white guys from England, so the narrative doesn't really stack up, right? So when people look at it, we've got like a full female legal team, full female finance team. We've got four really high level women, female advisors. And then really it's kind of like we're guided by them as to kind of where we go for our C-suite executives. Because really like my goal right now is to get us to 10 million of EBITDA and get out of the way, offer infrastructure and support. And then look at like the overall global picture, but really it's to get out of their way and let them run it.
And do they have any ownership in the SPVs?
We have given equity to some of our advisors, right? In the Topco, there will be some equity, but between us and the attorneys, we're doing like a vested equity period. So if they come in, there's like a 90-day to 180-day window where they have to validate the KPIs. Then they participate in a profit share up to a certain KPI, and then the equity kicks in. So one of the lessons that we learned very quickly was I wanted to kind of obviously the best team I possibly could. And again, you know, I make mistakes, and I did. I ended up giving equity up to someone who really shouldn't have had it. And then we had to terminate that, and it was a whole thing. So the legal team have said this is probably the best structure, and I kind of go with them. Our in-house counsel, James, who's on our board of directors, I've known him since I was 18 and living in London. I used to live with his sister and her boyfriend. So that's how long I've known him. And he's a 25-year corporate M&A attorney. So he's keeping us on the straight and narrow, and making sure that everything we do is 100% locked in.
Yeah. And is this, what's the long-term goal of the businesses? Is it buy and hold forever? And Warren Buffett talks about that. I'm holding forever, but he allocates capital. That's his job, right? If there's a mm-hmm. better IRR, he's going to go for it. He'll sell a company to go for it. Yeah.
Honestly, John, I don't think I'll ever do this again. It's been one of the most challenging, stressful. It's probably taken 10 years off my life.
Oh,
I'm only 26.
I get it.
But really, like we had a very strategic plan when we started doing this. And really, we've got a 5-year plan. We want to sell it. Our goal is to sell it for $1 billion or more to either private or on the public market. Like we want to get it publicly listed, and then just exit.
Was that NASDAQ or New York Stock?
NASDAQ. Yeah. Okay. Yeah, NASDAQ. Yeah. And Carl said two very important things to me, which really stuck in my mind. And as I was getting down the cap raising side of things and kind of really digging into the weeds of that kind of industry, right? And listen, I've got to be honest, I don't particularly enjoy it. I think it's a cesspit filled with cretins, but needs must.
Because right? It's all about money. It's numbers, right?
They're just all shady, right? Like they try and change deals at the 11th hour. They're very predatory. A lot of them are, which is the nature of the beast, right? It's like kill or be killed. But two things that Carl said to me, and it's always stuck with me, is one, the money is in the money. I was like, that is interesting. And then the other one is...
Did you explain it or did you have to go think about it? The
money's in the money. Like, here's the thing. Nobody wants, if we're being completely honest, nobody wants to own and run a business, right?
Nobody.
People want the benefit of the business. They want freedom, financial freedom, time freedom, right? So when I say I don't think I'll ever do this again, I'm on the other side of the money. Where I'm literally in the process now of GPing like a huge 5-co pool of funds from across the globe. So I don't want to be buying any more companies. I don't want to be having to help in the structure and the management. I just want to be a portion of the money and I can deploy that. So I don't have any of that responsibility. I just deploy it. So he said the money's in the money and that resonated with me. But here's the thing, you have to kind of go through those evolutions of your career. Like, it's very important that I'm doing this right now because I'm seeing every element of this business. But I wouldn't want to do this again, I don't think. Maybe.
Yeah, there's two things going to happen. So I understand what you're saying with the money is in the money, because if you've ever done a startup in Silicon Valley, you go through this process, you pivot 3 or 4 times, you're on the precipice of financial clap a number of times, and you have you raise the money on the 11th hour, almost falling apart, and then you have an exit, and there's no way you want to do that again. You just won't go through that.
Yeah,
like, the money's in the money, and if you do this, the money's going to come to you. It's going to be attracted to you. At some point, it goes like, hey, this future Ross Turner, is he the guy, right? I'm going to put my money behind Ross Turner, the next Ross Turner. Yeah.
Exactly. And the guys, especially when we were going out hunting down capital, like all they look at is the executive team, right? Do they have a track record? Do they have a track record of returning money to investors? Do we believe they can execute on the plan? That's essentially it. And it's funny you were talking about that before. You literally right now we're like an inch away from glory, or we're an inch away from disaster, and it is that fine balance, and that's just the reality of it, right? Yeah. Like we're juggling all of these things. 2-3 poor decisions can absolutely tank it, and that's just the reality. And it's like the world that we're living in. And I've enjoyed it. There's been times where I've wanted to bash my head against the desk. But here's the thing. I kept coming back every single day. And there was a time in the summer last year, me and Carl had, because Carl stayed at my house. He's actually coming to my house next week. But we had a week's worth of meetings and we got smacked in the mouth every day for a week. But we kept coming back and we kept coming back and we learned and we tweaked. And we're now at the stage now where we're like, right, okay, we've figured this out. Let's go and execute on it. And then let's see what's next. I think someone asked me this question because we had an event and I was speaking at the event and they said, like, where do you see yourself in like 3 to 5 years? And I said, the biggest thing for me is I want to sell everything. So like sell the company. If I'm co-GP in this other fund, like sell that, but also impact is a big thing, right? So if we look at the SMEs, it's responsible for what? Is it 80% of the global GDP? And it's the most underserved market on the planet. So if you go back and look at 2008, when Wall Street absolutely rinsed the globe, who had to pay for it? It's the general public and the small SMEs. So like my thought process has always been, Like, I'll take as much money, like now I've seen behind the curtain, I'll take as much money as I possibly can from them. And then we'll just go and deploy it into all of these deals in the SME space. Like, think of the impact, think of the jobs, think of the revenue, think of the impact it has on other people's lives. Like, it baffles me that it's still not that served a market. Like, it blows my mind.
Yeah, it's bigger than a pretty big tax base too.
Yeah, it is. Yeah.
Tax base, yeah. What was some of those pivots you talked about that really changed direction where you were going and then like smack right into a wall, got to pivot. Yeah.
Yeah, so the first one obviously was when the family office missed the capital call.
Oh, yeah.
So we were like, all right. But again,
he didn't tell you about that. Like, hey, man, I'm committing capital to you. Oh, I forgot to mention we're selling the.
Yeah, family. He didn't. We've butted heads. I still actually speak to him, but we butted heads a lot on it. I wasn't very impressed with how he handled himself. But
probably again, fortuitous about what may happen in the future. Yeah,
absolutely. Yeah. So it was kind of like a bittersweet moment. We'd signed a $125 million commitment from GEM. We were like, this is amazing. But then we missed the capital call. And then, you know, we'd had deals lined up ready to close. So those deals fell through. So we had to pivot then. And then really, like, I wouldn't say it was a quarter of dead time, but I had to learn very quickly that going after $10 million was kind of stupid. I need to go after the bigger check sizes. So then that was the other pivot. To kind of look at that. And then when I realized that that was possible, we kind of sat down as a team and a board and then said, well, why can't we go and raise another 55 and just do bigger deals, right? Like, let's just go and do bigger deals. It gets us to where we want to be quicker. You know, capital is like throwing fuel on the fire, right? Just like,
it doesn't always help. But yeah,
it doesn't always help, but generally it's like throwing fuel on the fire. It gives you options.
Yeah.
So those were the kind of the two major pivots. And another one was in terms of the team and operational infrastructure that we've got in place. We've had to like fire a couple of people. And really we changed our, and again, I don't want to sound too woo woo here, but kind of at the stage in my professional career where back in the day I'd want the most capable, smartest people working on the project. Whereas this one where like people need to really buy into it, they need to believe in it, and they need to be rowing in the same direction as us and have the same sort of ethics and energy. Right? So we tried to bring in a couple of people that just wasn't a cultural fit and that ended up being a bit of a problem. So that was another big pivot. Like when we realized that, here's the thing, you can basically train anybody to do anything, right? You can teach them to do pretty much anything, but you know, you can't teach morals, ethics, standards. Like that comes from internal.
That only comes out like later in a point of, you know, heat or under the crucible, like what your ethics looks like or, you know, what kind of person you are.
Exactly. Yeah, and those are the things that we've had to navigate, right? And as well as raising the capital, dealing with all the institutional elements, then we're also looking at deals and I'm having seller calls. Like before I came on the podcast, we had a seller call today and I brought like all of the team onto it, all the advisors, everything. And like we're just having to navigate and juggle all of that. So there's a lot, and our team's not, there's about 10 of us actually. So it is a fairly decent sized team. But yeah, we've had to learn a lot. And like I said, yeah. I'm not the smartest person in the room, so I've had to.
Well, I think you're humble and you're curious, so I think that helps a long way. If you just stay curious about this, you can go at the speed of learning. Like you can,
for sure.
You know, I think the ego. If the ego gets in, it goes like, I already know this. Mistakes will happen.
Oh yeah, yeah. I think one of the big, like one of my big kind of skill sets or superpowers, if you will, is I'm really good at understanding people and what they respond to. And I learned a long time ago to listen a lot more than you speak. Like I am wrong all of the time. Ask my wife. She'll tell you. I'm wrong. I am wrong all
my wife
all of the
knows
time.
Your wife. My
yeah,
wife.
There we go. But But I've got no problem with being wrong, right? Like, I like to not think that I know it all. And I think anybody who does that is a bit of a fool, and they're going to suffer for it. So, like, those are my two big things. Like, I listen very well, and I'm conscious of what people's needs are and kind of where their skill set is. And that's kind of been part of the success that we've had with this project so far. So
let me ask you about, are you still working on Carlisle Allen's team? Because, you know, raising capital and not yet buying and searching for doesn't generate revenue to pay the bills. What does that look like? Yeah.
Yeah. So obviously we raised capital initially from our original investors. So we've got OPEX costs within the business anyway.
So that's G&A. You need.
So we have a monthly cash burn that's going on in the company right now. But like I said, we're going to close on our first major acquisition probably in around, I'd say, 3 weeks. And then that gets us to 62% of the way to our target. And then the rest is just a case of lining them up and knocking them off.
So when you say you need the seller to stay on, are we talking about kind of like a private equity structure where you buy 60%, they're keeping 30 or something?
So we don't force that, right? What we'd like to do is we like to basically tell the founders and the owners that we want to give you two capital events, right? We want to buy your business for what it's currently worth, fair market value. And then we're going to turn it into a best-in-class business. We're going to get the economies of scale and the multiples arbitrage by being part of a bigger group. And then if you roll a portion of that deal into the Topco, when we sell that, you get a second capital event. So that's kind of what we'd like to do. And then our kind of goal is to have the female founder owners to be the creative non-exec director. Essentially, so we say, hey, what's your vision? What's your massive vision for this business? They have none of the financial responsibility because they've already been paid out. So their decisions are not based on, oh, well, we need to do this, we need to do that. It's based on purely where they see the growth of their business. And here's the thing, nobody knows their business like themselves, right? Like we don't. There's things that they know that we would never know. So
yeah, don't be so arrogant buying a business. There's a lot of times these people that run this business for 10 years, hey, we tried that, didn't work. You know, why didn't work? Don't be so arrogant and come in and go, oh, I'm going to go do this. I'm going to go do that. I'm going to go do that. Well, it didn't work. Exactly. Yeah.
Exactly that. And like, we're big on continuity as well. Like, don't fix anything that's not broken. We just want to implement our five profit pillars. And then we want to give them the creative freedom to say, right, where should this brand go? And it will just, they'll act independently, right? And then, you know, all things being equal, they get two capital events at the end. So,
yeah. And as you said, there's a new dictionary in this industry, second bite of the apple. Yeah.
Exactly that. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, that's a fantastic story. And I wish you the best of success with this first acquisition and moving forward with this. Cause like, I got like, where did this go? You go, oh my God, these are big numbers, much more than I've ever seen. Where did you go? Like, we can do this.
Yeah. I wish, like I said at the start, I really needed to logically think if it was feasible from an integrations and an operations standpoint.
Uh huh.
And if it was, then where do we kind of play? And the numbers and like when you're in it and you're working in it, it's, you don't really think about what you're doing, right? You're just like next, 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 next. And then Christmas last year, excuse me, I got to spend 20 days in Australia. My sister lives out there. So there was me, my wife, my sister, and my mum. And like for the first time in about 14 months, I sat down and was just like, holy smokes, look at what we've done. Like I was actually able to take stock and say, we've done an incredible job here. And enjoy that moment, that brief moment. But yeah, it's been a wild, wild ride. And it's by no means over yet either.
No. You're just starting. People are talking.
I know. That's the thing. And we're just getting started, right? Like,
yeah.
It's exciting. It's scary. It's stressful. It's daunting. It's all of those things wrapped up into one. But I wouldn't change it at all for the world.
Yeah.
I got
a question. Preparing for Black Swan events, like how you two, Carl, work together, like what's in place if something like this happens?
That's a good question. I think like we've tried to look at all possible downside eventualities, right? Like how would this ultimately fail? And our kind of, you know, we're going to be bullish on the project anyway, but Carl's like, listen, the only way this fails is if Putin starts firing nukes and the whole world shuts down. He's like, it's got too much momentum. And I think one of the key things is, though, John, as well, it's being very selective about the acquisitions, our first few acquisitions that get dropped into the group. That's the springboard for either success or failure, right? So we've learned a lot of lessons, speaking to a lot of PE, middle market guys as well, taking a lot of their lessons that they've shared with us, and just being very mindful, right? Like if it does, to us, if it's not a hell yes, then it's a no. Like I said, we looked at hundreds of deals and 99% of them were.
Yeah. Do you have ideas that, you know, familiar with Constellation out of Canada? The guy gives authority to the business units to make their own acquisitions. He doesn't even say yes or no anymore. It's just the business units makes the acquisitions.
That's incredible. Yeah. I would love to. I think it's important to have your hands around, like doing something for the first time. You want to be involved in every kind of element.
Yeah, you just want the experience. Yeah.
Yeah. But I mean, in the future, like I said earlier on, like the money's in the money. So people are just going to be doing deals and I won't have to be running it. I'll be on the other side of the fence. Yeah.
I want to make money with my money. Ross Turner, thanks for being on the show. Really, really appreciate it.
Thank you so much, John. Really appreciate it. Really enjoyed it.
Yeah.
Thanks, buddy.
All right. Hold on 1 second.
I hope this video has inspired you. If you need help buying your first $1 million business, make sure to visit me at dealflowsystem.net. If you like this video, make sure you subscribe down below. Comment on it, share it, tell everyone about it. And thanks for watching.